The Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development will now be in order. Today's date is Thursday, March 19th, 2015. So I thank those who have gathered here for this important review. We are joined by our legislative auditor, Mr. Nobles, Ms. Sawicki. We're grateful for your work and for your presentation today. I'd like to begin by just giving folks an overview. So number one, this happens to be, for anyone who doesn't follow the legislature as closely as those of us who live and breathe it, this is first deadline week. And so many members have bills up in committees, and so their not sitting here is not any indication of whether or not they wanted to be here. And so we do expect that members will come in and out. But we know that they have been all given a copy of the report and so can appreciate that they will be reviewing that. I've been higher ed chair. This is my third year. And when I first became chair, people, you know, as somebody new, they write you and they say, we want you to know about this, we want you to know about that, you should look into this, you should look into that. And so I took in a lot of information. And one of the things that really stuck out and concerned me was the communication I received from constituents. And then as I looked more into it, as I saw in the media, allegations regarding the Markinson suicide case. And so as a new chair, I looked into it at first by, you know, speaking to the university and asking for more information and reading what I could about it and speaking to the legislative auditor. And we came to the conclusion that there really had been a tremendous amount of inquiry into the subject. And so at that time, I did not ask the legislative auditor to do a review. As time went on, more information came across my desk. I, in particular, the KMSP Fox stories with regard to this case. There was recently, last fall, an additional story that raised the concern that I re-looked at it, and I again went to legislative auditor, Mr. Nobles. We talked about it, and I requested, and he agreed and agreed with the request that, in fact, it was worth doing a legislative auditor review on this matter. And so this has been going on for some time. It is certainly the material before you is very thorough. And so the other thing I just want to say on the record about this is that we're talking about a matter that happened a long time ago. And in fact, most of the people who now will be speaking on behalf of the university were not at the university at the time that it happened. So then you can ask, well, why spend this time? Why put this much effort and attention on something that happened so long ago? And I think the answers are obvious, but I think, though obvious, worth stating. And that is that it is imperative that the University of Minnesota not only have the highest reputation with regard to the treatment of human subjects, particularly vulnerable human subjects, but the highest code of conduct and the highest ethics with regard to it. And it is my belief philosophically that you can't make sure that what you're doing in the present and setting forth a plan for the future can really happen unless you've thoroughly examined and been held to account for the past. And so while we will be speaking to folks who weren't there, we know they now are entrusted with the public trust. And so we are having this conversation from that perspective, that we know that our leaders of today are held in the highest regard, and they are the ones charged with the public trust. So I look forward to the conversation in that spirit. And with that, just in terms of the format, we'll be having first legislative audit report, followed by the Faculty Senate's report, and then we will ask the administration and also the regents to come to the table for questions and comments, and then open it up, of course, if there are people in the audience who have comments or questions. So with that, thank you very much, Legislative Auditor, Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Elizabeth Stawicki, who is the Director of legal research at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for being here. We think this is an important matter, and we appreciate you giving us this time to present our report. I would like to start, Madam Chair, by calling on Ms. DeWicke to make an opening statement.
For the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth DeWicke, and I am the Director of Legal Research at the OLA.
And Ms. DeWicke, can you bring the microphone closer to you? Thank you.
We found that that University of Minnesota leadership misled the public when it said the death of a man participating in one of its drug studies had been thoroughly reviewed and, as a result, had cleared the university of any wrongdoing. The case concerns the death of Dan Markingson, who killed himself while participating in a Department of Psychiatry drug trial. While the death occurred more than a decade ago, debate about this case has only intensified concerning the university's response and the ethics of recruiting mentally ill patients into industry-sponsored drug research. We say at the outset that we were unable to conclude whether Dan Markingson's suicide was connected to his participation in the drug study. There were so many conflicting reports about his mental health, and there are many factors that can contribute to the suicide of a person suffering from serious mental illness. Nonetheless, the Markingson case raises serious ethical issues and numerous conflicts of interest that we'll be discussing in more detail today. When we talk about some of the high-level ethical concepts, such as conflict of interest, for example, we must keep in mind that we're talking about a human being, Dan Markingson. As such, we need to give you a brief synopsis about how this case began. In the summer of 2003, 26-year-old Dan Markingson, a University of Michigan graduate, was an aspiring screenwriter living in Los Angeles. To make ends meet, he drove a tour bus pointing out the homes of celebrities. That same year, however, Markingson's mother, Mary Weiss, came out to visit him and noticed disturbing changes in her son's behavior. He thought an alien had burned a spot on his carpet, and he set up wooden posts to create an astral field around his bed. A few months later, while visiting his mother in Minnesota, he talked about taking part in a satanic ritual in which he might be required to kill people, including his mother. In response, she called police, who took him to Regents Hospital, where medical staff determined he was mentally ill and posed a danger to himself and others. Due to a lack of available beds, Markingson was transferred to Fairview University Medical Center and placed under the care of Dr. Stephen Olson, a psychiatrist and an associate professor in the University of Minnesota's Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Olson wrote in support of Fairview's petition to commit Markingson to Anoka Regional Treatment Center, a long-term state psychiatric hospital. 3 days later, a judge signed an initial commitment order which confined Markingson to Fairview for additional evaluation and diagnosis. Dr. Olson had also started Markingson on an antipsychotic drug, Risperdal, which appeared to stabilize him. On November 18, 2003, a neuropsychologist estimated that Markingson's overall intellectual functioning was in the superior range. She also reported that he seemed to understand instructions, except on a somewhat complex task when he repeatedly asked for instructions even after they were given. 2 days later, he appeared in court for his commitment hearing. The judge stayed or put on hold his commitment for 6 months on the condition that he cooperate with Fairview's treatment plan and follow all of the treatment team's aftercare recommendations. Dr. Olson was also leading a university drug research study known by the acronym as the CAFE study. The university was one of 26 sites around the U.S. and Canada. Funded by drug maker AstraZeneca, it compared AstraZeneca's antipsychotic drug Seroquel with two competitors. The FDA had already approved the three drugs as safe and effective treatments for schizophrenia. The day after Markingson's commitment hearing, the CAFE studies coordinator Gene Kenny and another study researcher performed an evaluation of Markingson, which indicated that he was competent to give informed consent to take part in the study. Kenny read Markinson the 10-page informed consent document as he followed along with his copy. Markinson then signed the document. About 2 weeks later, Dr. Olson started Markinson on the randomized study drug. Because it was a double-blind study, Dr. Olson and no one on the treatment team knew which drug Markinson was now taking. We now know that the study drug was different from the one Markinson had been taking. The new drug was Seroquel. 3 days later, Dr. Olson discharged Markinson to a group home for people with mental illness. Even though Markinson was no longer at the hospital, there were many people watching his behavior. His mother, his study treatment team, including Dr. Olson and Jean Kenny, staff at his Fairview Day treatment program and his group home, a psychologist in Eagan, and his social worker, David Pettit. Over the next 5 months, Mary Weiss consistently reported that her son's mental health was getting worse and that his medicine was not working. She wanted him out of this thing. Everyone else watching Markinson generally thought he was doing well. On May 5th, 2004, Markinson completed his day treatment program. 3 days later, he violently killed himself.
Madam Chair, we have 9 findings in our report. One of them, the last one, relates to the external panel report, and you're going to hear that separately after our presentation. So we will leave that for the representative of that report to present to you. But I do want to start by quoting something that one of the external panel members said during the university faculty senate meeting, and we attended that meeting, and we had an opportunity to speak to the two of the panel members afterwards. And Dr. David Strauss, who is a psychiatrist, a professor at Columbia University, was asked about what level of compliance one should expect in the treatment of human subjects in drug studies. It was pointed out that there are many laws and there are many rules and other kinds of requirements that have been codified. But what Dr. Strauss said, and I quote, "The regulations are only the floor. Any institution that aims that low is likely not to be going to do a fairly good job." So we think that's a theme throughout our report, that yes, the university can point to its compliance with certain laws, certain requirements at the time, although I think our report reveals that there was non-compliance in some respects as well. So our first finding relates to what kind of standard needs to be met when you are dealing with a human subject who is highly vulnerable and you are attempting to recruit him into a drug study. Dan Markinson, as Ms. DeWicke has pointed out, was highly vulnerable when he was enrolled in the drug study. And I want to call again on Ms. DeWicke to just highlight a few of those vulnerabilities.
Well, different reports have characterized Markinson as vulnerable, but it's important to explain how he was vulnerable. Try to put yourself in this situation. He arrived psychotic. He was suffering from delusions. For the first time in his life, he was confined to a locked psychiatric unit with very sick people. He was also diagnosed with a serious mental illness. He was now on a powerful drug. And he was dependent on Dr. Olson, his treating physician, not only for his care, but also who was a key person in determining whether he would live independently again. What we found troubling was Dr. Olson's two very different roles as treating physician and researcher. That meant Markinson was his patient and his research subject. In addition, there was the added element that Markinson was under a stay of commitment and potentially faced commitment to a psychiatric hospital if he did not comply with the treatment plan.
Madam Chair, members, we think this raises very serious concerns about coercion. And again, we realize that Dr. Olson and others at the university dispute this, but we point to the fact that many others have pointed to the circumstances under which Dan Markinson was recruited into the CAFE study as presenting coercion or at least the possibility, when a person is under a stay of commitment. And I would just like to quote from some guidance that is provided by the Department of Health and Human Services about the treatment of human subjects in drug studies. The impact of institutionalization may further compromise a patient's ability to exercise free choice. The eagerness for release may induce an institutionalized person, especially one who is involuntarily confined, to participate in research out of a desire to appear, quote, rational or cooperative to those who will make decisions about whether he or she is released. Others, too, have talked to a situation like Dan Markinson was in as potentially coercive. It was a point raised, and again, in the external panel. The panel said in their report, the fear of being subjected to an involuntary legal process for perceived non-cooperation, even if there is no direct threat of such legal compulsion, is an overwhelming barrier to volunteering to participate. I would also point out that in its examination of the situation under which Dan Markinson was recruited, the state's ombudsman for mental health also raised the concern of coercion. So, Madam Chair, we think again that the university did not meet the highest standards of ethical concern. They may have followed the law that was in place at the time, but we think that they should have given heed to some of the guidance that was already out there about the potential for a person who was in Dan's position not being able to freely consent to be in a drug study. I think the most compelling thing is that this case of Dan Markinson and the circumstances under which he was recruited into the drug study were presented to the Minnesota legislature in 2009. And you, the legislature, heard the story of how he was recruited, and you passed Dan's law, which said that should never happen again. You made it so that a person who is under a stay of commitment cannot be recruited into a drug study except for very unusual circumstances. If there is a compelling need, then a physician can go to the court and petition for that person to be allowed into a drug study. But again, what the legislature said, that physician cannot be both the treating physician and the head of the drug study, which Dr. Olson was. The point here is that it took you, the Minnesota legislature, to codify what should have been a consideration as an ethical concern when Dan Markinson was recruited into the drug study. I don't think, under the circumstances, the university can claim it was upholding the highest ethical standards at that time. Next, Madam Chair, we want to point to the fact, and again, Ms. DeWicke had referenced this, that this drug study was sponsored by the drug manufacturer AstraZeneca. We believe that the circumstances of that funding created an incentive to enroll Dan Markinson in the drug study. First of all, AstraZeneca was paying the University of Minnesota on a per-participant basis, and they were prorating those payments on the number and length of participation by the human subjects. The university goal in the CAFE study was to enroll 30 subjects. We know from the record that we reviewed that Dr. Olson was having difficulty meeting that goal. So again, we think that the circumstances under which Dan Markinson was enrolled in the study was under a circumstance that had an incentive to meet the goal to receive the payment from AstraZeneca. I'd now like to turn to our third finding and ask Ms. DeWicke to talk about what we consider quite inadequate communication with Dan Markinson's mother, Mary Weiss.
Markinson's mother, Mary Weiss, expressed strong concerns about her son taking part in the drug study. But there is little evidence that the study team adequately followed up with her about those concerns. Although Dan Markinson was an adult, he signed a release authorizing Dr. Olson and the treatment team to verbally share his medical information with his mother. Mary Weiss continued to be a presence in her son's life, driving him back and forth to appointments. She constantly told the treatment team that her son was not doing well. She told them Dan thought people were speaking to him through the television. She saw a rage in him, and that he had told her he had, quote, fooled the doctors. In mid-April of 2004, Mary Weiss, who had seen her son that day, left an alarming message on study coordinator Jean Kenny's phone. She said, "Do we have to wait until he kills himself or anyone else before anyone does anything?" The treatment team did not document her call until 4 days later, and there's no evidence that anyone followed up with her for at least a week. Throughout her son's time in the CAFE study, she wrote letters to Dr. Olson and Dr. Schultz, the head of the department. 2 weeks before Markinson died, she wrote Dr. Schultz to ask, "If this were your son, would you allow him to be placed into a study where you did not know what medication he was on? And what action would you take if you knew he was not getting better?" Dr. Schultz replied, "I would have to answer that I would be very interested in my son receiving treatment in a well-organized treatment trial that has been run by such effective staff as Dr. Olson and Jeannie Kenny." What Mary Weiss did not know was that Dr. Olson had helped Dr. Schultz write that letter, and that Schultz was also a co-investigator in the CAFE study and a paid AstraZeneca consultant. Our next finding concerns an advocate for Dan Markinson. When Dr. Olson applied to the university's committee that approves research studies, he described precautions he would take to minimize the risk to human subjects. One of those was that subjects like Dan Markinson would have an advocate. We asked Dr. Olson who was Dan's advocate, and he told us social worker David Pettit. But while Markinson signed the informed consent document on November 21st, Dakota County had not assigned Pettit to Markinson until 3 days later, on November 24th. Pettit also would not meet Markinson face-to-face until November 26th. As a result, there was no one independent of the study when Dan signed the consent form. That's important because, remember, Dan was facing a potential commitment to a state psychiatric hospital if he didn't comply with the treatment team's plan. Because there was no one independent of the study when Markinson signed the consent form, it's impossible to know what impact of being locked up under a stay of commitment had on his ability to freely consent.
Madam Chair, one of the things that has concerned us is the number of times that the university has made statements, as Ms. DeWicke referenced, that the Dan Markinson case has been thoroughly, internally, and externally reviewed. One of the reviews they have pointed to is a review by an organization known as the Institutional Review Board, the IRB, which is an organization within the university that is required that approves studies such as the CAFE study and has a responsibility to protect human subjects. So again, the claim the university has made is that there was a review by the university's Institutional Review Board of the Markinson suicide, and they have characterized it as a full board review, and that board, the IRB, reviews every adverse event in a rigorous way. And I don't think we can imagine any adverse event, which is a somewhat euphemistic term for anything that goes wrong in a drug study. I don't think we can find any kind of adverse event worse than a suicide. So we ask, how rigorous, how in-depth, how extensive was this IRB review? We found it to be quite superficial. There were no interviews. There was no examination of medical records. They simply asked Dr. Olson to make a submission to the IRB. This is the review that the IRB conducted. A submission, a one-page submission by Dr. Olson. That's the only documentation we could find of any kind of review by the IRB. So, somewhat dismayed that could be characterized as a full board, rigorous review, we talked to the current chair of the university's IRB, And we expressed our concern, how could it be characterized that way? And she said, well, there were no requests for interviews or to review medical records, so none was done. So in other words, the IRB didn't feel like it was necessary for them, as an organization created to protect human subjects, to initiate on its own an investigation. Again, we were perplexed by that. And so we ask, you know, how is this system run in a way that truly protects human subjects? And the current IRB chair said, and I quote, if you don't trust your investigators, then the whole system doesn't work. Then we ask, well, what about the axiom, trust but verify, especially in a circumstance where there's been a death? And she said, and again I quote, the general consensus here is really you trust your investigators. We also reviewed another review of the Markingston suicide, which was done by the Board of Social Work. And now you might wonder, why would the Board of Social Work be involved in something like this? But you've heard the name Jean Kenney referred to by Ms. DeWicke, and she was the coordinator for the CAFE study. She was also a registered social worker. And Mary Weiss filed allegations against Jean Kenney for her performance in the CAFE study. The board reviewed the allegations, and they found some very serious problems. And I would refer you to page 23 of our report, where we enumerate the fact that the board found that Ms. Kenney had been delegated medical tasks for which she had little to no training, and that were beyond her competency, and that in carrying out those tasks, she made serious errors. She at times confused hyperthyroidism and hypothyroidism on medical records, which then had to be corrected. So they found serious problems, and they entered into a corrective action with Jean Kenney. They did not formally discipline her. But if you simply read the findings of the board and the agreement for corrective action, I think you're quite concerned that a person in this position was delegated those tasks and not adequately supervised. And ultimately, we think that responsibility rested with Dr. Olson. He was the principal investigator, and he was responsible for all of the staff who were a part of that study.
Our next finding concerns the Board of Medical Practices review of Dr. Olson's care of Dan Markingston. University leaders have consistently pointed to the Board of Medical Practices review as evidence that the Markingston case has been thoroughly reviewed. The Board of Medical Practice regulates physicians, and its purpose is to protect the public. But we found the board's expert consultant who reviewed the case had numerous conflicts of interest, which undermined his and the review's credibility. The board dismissed the complaint, and in a letter to Mary Weiss, the board said, quote, an independent expert consultant had reviewed all of the investigative data. We found that expert had multiple conflicts of interest, including he was a colleague of Dr. Olson. He was a member of the committee that approved Dr. Olson's application to conduct the CAFE study, and he had extensive connections to drug companies. We believe these conflicts seriously compromised his credibility and the review's conclusion.
So, Madam Chair, our last finding, and again, we will leave our other finding related to the external panel for that to be presented to you by a representative of that study. But I think what it came down to for us most of all is that we felt university leaders have dismissed the need for further review of the Markingston case repeatedly. And I think the review that we conducted and the findings we brought forth to you today show that the Markingston case, in fact, needed a review. We think that by not reviewing the Markingston case openly and critically, that the university ignored serious ethical issues. We think that they have, in fact, made misleading statements. As I said, relative to the IRB review. It was far, far short of anything I think any of us would consider rigorous. Also of concern is that the university has been willing to pick and choose what it cites in terms of reviews. It has disregarded reviews that had negative findings, such as the Board of Social Work. They've simply called that incorrect. The board was wrong. They have not taken an opportunity to take reviews like that or like the one conducted by the Ombudsman for Mental Health and really critically ask themselves, are we meeting the highest ethical standards? Did we in the Markinson case? I think clearly the facts demonstrate they did not. And again, we will leave the external panel, which found there are systematic problems today. You know, as the chair mentioned at the beginning, this is an event that happened long ago. So it could have been possible for the university to say, this is history. We've made significant improvements. But as we know from the external panel, they found systematic problems on the university campus today in the way human subjects are protected. So what should we do, Madam Chair? What should the legislature do? Well, we believe that you should enact a law that requires the university to fully implement the external panel's recommendations before any additional Department of Psychiatry drug studies receive approval at the university. Human subjects under these circumstances are simply too vulnerable without strengthening the protections that were suggested by the external panel. And we think the legislature ought to require that in law of the university. We also believe that you, in law, should authorize and fund the state's Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disability to monitor what occurs at the university in psychiatric drug studies. We don't think trust is enough. We believe in trust but verify. And we think that verification at this stage needs to come from outside the university. With that, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Ms. Stawicki, I'm sure the members do have questions. I have been your partner throughout this in terms of being kept up to date as this investigation is unfolded, and it has been deeply disturbing as you have shared what you've shared today and what has been revealed. And so I just want to note that as I listen, I think about the family, and I think of the family of Dan Markinson, and with sorrow and compassion. And so I appreciate, again, here we are talking about something so long ago, but perhaps by revealing what went wrong back then, that family will be able to have some semblance of peace, whatever possibility of peace in terms of being able to move on from this tragedy. So thank you. So members, questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the thorough review. I think I heard you say that there are still systemic problems today, and I would like to know what those problems are and if, in fact, the recommendations that you have made will address those problems.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nobles.
Senator Nelson. Along the same time frame that we were asked to do this special review, the University Senate faculty was considering the need for an outside review as well. And the Faculty Senate enacted a resolution asking the administration to bring in an outside panel of experts to review current practice in protecting human subjects in drug trials at the university. They did that, and that is my reference to the systematic problems that exist today. And just as soon as we are finished, you're going to hear a presentation of that panel report as well. So I want to leave it to them to cover that with you.
Just the follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So as we hear that, Will the recommendation that you have made regarding fully implementing the external review panel recommendations, then that those are the recommendations that you're speaking of?
That's correct. They were very detailed. Again, we actually, in one of our footnotes, cite the credentials of the expert panel. I think we were highly impressed with not only their credentials, but with their frankness, the thoroughness of their review, and the way in which they charted a path to strengthen human subject protection going forward. So we felt it was unnecessary for us to do that since that's already been done. What I think we added was a request by the legislature to require the university to implement those recommendations.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, and then Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Noble, I'm having a kind of a difficult time balancing, you know, the need as a legislator to hear what happened in this case and be sensitive to the case and to the family and understanding the value and the responsibility to understand what happened in that case. And I'm having a hard time balancing that with your review of a very large institution that does a lot of research in many, many, many areas. So my question to you is, in reviewing this case, are you suggesting that the University of Minnesota truly does not protect human subjects? Are you suggesting that they are not meeting the highest ethical standards based on a review of one case? I don't know if you had the time to review more cases, if you had time to review more documentation related to other cases, because this is a case. And as much as I said, I want to be sensitive to that case and how this might have been handled by a professional who did the investigation, a researcher. There are a lot of researchers at the University of Minnesota, and there are a lot of investigations taking place. So how do we arrive to the conclusions that you are arriving? I would like to hear more in detail.
Madam Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I think it's an absolutely important consideration, and we would be the first to admit, and did just shortly ago, and as the Chair did as well, this is history. This is what happened over 10 years ago. But I think, again, what I would come back to is, yes, we are talking about one case where the university, in our estimation, did not uphold the highest ethical standards the way it recruited and treated Dan Markingson. But you will shortly hear a presentation from an external panel of experts, people with wide experience in psychiatry, in drug studies, who came here from other academic institutions and studied what is going on in the protection of human subjects in psychiatric drug studies at the University of Minnesota today. And they said the university is not meeting the highest ethical standards. They made recommendations for strengthening human subject protections in drug studies. And so it isn't my assertion. It's the assertion of this panel of experts that said the University of Minnesota is not today doing an adequate job of protecting human subjects in drug studies. And that they did not look at the Markingson case. The fact that they were not going to is why we did. So I think you have in front of you, to some degree, complementary reports, one from the past, another one in current time, about what is going on at the university now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ortman. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions, and this one does go back in history a little bit, but I stumbled over this, what I thought I heard you say, which is that Mr. Markingson had been initially treated with risperidol, and that I can't remember if you said that he had been stabilized in terms of his psychotic symptoms on that drug
yes.
prior to being invited into this study. Did I understand you to say that correctly?
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Nobles.
Senator Sharon, that is correct.
And so since the person, you know, is what confuses me about that is why, if a person is doing well on a medication, what is the what is the responsibility of a treating person to retaining that stable situation rather than inviting the person into a study? I don't understand what the benefit to the patient is. I understand what the benefits to the university were, but what is the benefit to the patient there? How do you justify a stabilized person who's under other circumstances might be civilly committed, may not need to be civilly committed if they're treated and their psychosis is managed on risperidone? I don't understand what happened there. Can you help me understand that better?
Mr. Madam Nobles. Chair, Senator Sharon, I think you raised a central point, which is a point we raise as well, but is raised throughout the literature on consideration of the bioethics of recruiting somebody into a drug study. And one of the central concerns is the potential conflict between somebody being both the treating physician and the leader of a drug study. And that was the situation in this case. Dr. Stephen Olson was leading the CAFE study, and he was also Dan Markinson's treating physician. I agree with you. It raises a very serious ethical issue that Dr. Olson did not continue Dan Markinson on a drug that was, by Dr. Olson's own assessment, working to move him onto a drug in a drug study. And I would remind you, too, that moving him into the drug study meant Dr. Olson nor anyone else knew what drug Dan was now on. It was a double-blinded study. So how you can be a treating physician under those circumstances, I think, raises a very big concern.
And Senator Sharon, I might add that with regard to this particular matter, the legislature did act in 2009 when we passed what was called then Dan's Law that said you couldn't both be the person doing the study and the treating physician. So we did, in fact, address that very conflict legislatively.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, but I also will want to understand the justification in any research project for taking a person who's vulnerable with a psychosis, obvious psychosis, successfully being treated with a medication and then asking them to engage in a study that may or may not take them off of the very drug that's managing their life. So it's not just the decision makers, but that whole principle. Let's say you separate the physician from the researcher. I still have the question of whether or not this is an appropriate ethical action to take, to ask somebody in that situation to take the risk with what it can be a very, very difficult disease to manage. Switching medications is a problem here. So then I just would add, I have a million questions, but I also thought I heard you say that the Markinson case lacked an advocate when he was enrolled. I know that you said that, but I thought I heard you say that a stay of commitment was required Dan to cooperate with Fairview team or face placement in a psychiatric facility. I mean, that's a blatant threat to me, and I want to know if that's what you meant, that that was clearly communicated to the person that or even innuendoed, or is it something, a subtle anxiety that you described early? Stay of commitment required Dan to cooperate with Fairview team or face placement in a psychiatric facility. Would you extend your conversation about that?
Yes, Madam Chair. We were not
Mr. Noble.
Creating an innuendo at all. We were quoting from the commitment order itself. This is what the judge said in the stay of commitment, that it would be stayed for 6 months if the respondent, Dan Markinson, remain hospitalized, cooperate with the treatment plan at Fairview University Medical Center until medically discharged, and follow all the aftercare recommendations of the treatment team, or, as it says here, be committed to Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. Now, in fairness, I think others would say, Dr. Olson would say, that Dan could have still withdrawn from the study and there might have been other treatment options. Whether Dan understood that or not, I think we'll never know, because what seems, I think, to be clear to anyone who reads this He had two options. One, he could go to Anoka, the psychiatric hospital, with possibly an undetermined amount of time there, or he could cooperate with his treatment team at Fairview, which principally was Dr. Olson. Dr. Olson's treatment plan became not to maintain him on the original drug, but to switch him to the drug study.
Well, and I'll just let others ask
Senator
questions
Chair.
I could ask all day. But I think that I just would highlight what I'm hearing being said. We have a person who had an obvious psychosis, was being successfully treated on risperidone. If you successfully treat somebody and you're managing their illness, the conditions and the grounds for civil commitment are going to go away. So this order just absolutely confounds me that if that's correct, that the risperidone was adequately treating the disease, and yet this patient was being told that they would be committed if they didn't participate in an alternative treatment option when one was already discovered and found to be effective. I need to make sure that when we're talking now about what we're going to do to make sure that this systematic issues that you're discovering make it impossible to recreate that kind of a scenario.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, one of the things, we didn't actually make this as a recommendation, but I think it's one worth certainly you considering, and that is that that if a person is on any kind of stay of commitment, there is any thought at that point that they are going to be asked to be in a drug study, that the judge be aware of that. But I think to some degree, you have already taken care of that with Dan's Law. As long as Dan's Law is being implemented and complied with, because in that case, there is an exception that if you want to have a person under a stay of commitment be in a drug study, as I said before, you have to go back to the judge, and you have to not be both the treating physician and the study principal. But I think your point, Senator Sharon, is that if the treating physician sees the patient improving, the treating physician under high ethical standards would not consider withdrawing that medication to put that patient on another medication when the treating physician doesn't even know. He knows it's one of three possibilities, but doesn't know exactly which one it is.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your very good work on this. I am concerned, really struck by the number of conflicts on the parts of so many of the participants all along the process, not just Dr. Olson, but the review folks at the university, the review board, the medical board of practitioners, that review. Everybody seemed to have a conflict here. And I'm concerned, I want to know if you think the expert panel review has a broad enough scope to it. Because you've talked about this being a psychiatric drug test. Should we be putting recommendations and requirements together for all drug tests? I mean, is their review broad enough to really ensure that the university's drug studies are not going to suffer from similar conflicts going forward? Is it broad enough?
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, members, I think it's an excellent point. And, you know, I think one of the things that has to come out of all of this is that the university, and it would be principally through the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, really needs to revisit their conflict of interest standards, and as does the Board of Medical Practice.
Right.
We visited with the Board of Medical Practice, and I think in fairness they would argue to you that oftentimes they're dealing with a very small population of specialists. They had dealt with an individual that didn't serve as their consultant before. I think we failed to mention that this person who they hired acknowledged the conflicts from the beginning when approached by the Board of Medical Practice to possibly be the consultant for a review of the Dr. Olson case. He said, but I've got a lot of conflicts, at least that would be perceived by others, that I want you to make aware of. response of the Board of Medical Practice was, well, if you think you can be objective or fair, we'll let you do it. I don't think that's an appropriate decision on the Board of Medical Practice. They say that it's hard for them to recruit people to be consultants. They typically do not go outside the state of Minnesota. But I think the conflicts in this particular case are so glaring and so numerous that they really draw into question not only the credibility of the review of the Olson case, the Dan Markinson case, under the Board of Medical Practice, but if that is the norm by the board by which they choose independent consultants, I think we really need to revisit that as a state entity. And then the university needs to revisit its standards for conflict of interest through the IRB. Just one final comment. I mean, this was alarming to us as well, and that's why, you know, we raised the issue over and over again of conflicts of interest. We found them at every stage. It seems to me we're dealing with a system that gets too insular, too closed, where everybody sort of says, well, this is the way it works. I know Dr. Smith over there. He can be objective. And, you know, I think anybody looking at it from the outside would immediately say, if they're colleagues, if they're tied together on various kinds of drug studies, if they have similar financial interests, no, they can't be independent from one another. But within that system, people say, no, it's just the way things are done.
Madam Chair. Senator Ortman.
Maybe you can't answer this question today, but what I'm asking you to do is go back and look at the scope of our expert review, this panel review, and advise us as a legislature, do we need additional reviews, broader reviews? Do we need to convene another expert panel to look at drug testing generally? Do we need to look at that Board of Medical Practice? So please advise us on what are our next steps here to make sure that we don't just address the singular problem or even the psychiatric drug studies, but the much larger problem that I see here.
We will do that for
Mr.
sure.
Mr. Nobles,
I appreciate
and
that.
And members, secret. I want to remind you that on your Senate desk today, you had a worksheet where you were asked to recommend what the legislative auditor should take on as its next review. And I would advocate for the Medical Practice Board being at the top of that list. This is not the first time we've heard about issues associated with the actions of the Medical Practice Board. If you recall the expose and the star trib just a year ago. So that's going to be at the top of my list. Senator.
Chair, if I could just add one final point on that, and I think it's an important one. A lot of these things take place behind closed doors with very tight data practice restrictions. In fact, the Board of Medical Practice, under its interpretation of their review of the allegations against Dr. Olson, their view is they can never even acknowledge that there were any allegations or they ever did a review. So we felt it lawful for us to raise the issue because the university has used that, and there have been documents by the principals that were involved that have been disclosed. In fact, you can find them on websites. And so we thought it was important to dig deeper. And we were able, as you know, with our authority, to see all data regardless of classification, many documents that, frankly, the legislature or anyone else will never see unless we do a legislative auditor review like the one we did.
So Senator Kent and then Senator Sheeran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we're talking about scientific research like this, obviously independence pertains to the efficacy of the results in general. Independence when it comes to human subjects takes on a whole new level of significance. And when we're talking about a vulnerable population, you would want to see so many checks and double checks in that regard, and I think you've identified that really well. And I think as we're all reacting, there are a number of areas of concern. One that caught my attention in particular is the Hughes Institutional Review Board. And I know this might be addressed by the external panel recommendations, but I was looking at President Kaler's letter that's printed at the end of the report, and one of the actions that they're talking about is suspending activities until they've been reviewed by an independent institutional review board. That, I have to say right now, doesn't give me a whole lot of comfort because I, you know, again, independence is really important. I would just like to know, based on what you've been working on, this is at the bottom of the first page of President Kaler's letter, do you have any thoughts at this point? And again, they may be addressed by the panel, but I would be curious to know if you have any thoughts about that at this time.
And Senator Kent, also, as you see, we've got President yes. Kaler and many
others.
We'll
ask that question, too.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, specifically
Mr.
back
Nobles.
To the question of conflicts of interest, again, I think that there simply needs to be more outside intervention into the university with other perspectives than those within what I said in the report, we said, is a very insular system. And so I think you can get to a point where you simply don't see the conflicts. So I, too, have concerns about just turning this over to the IRB within the university. They didn't see that these were conflicts in the past. They didn't see that some of the issues that have been raised by others were ethical concerns in the past. So I think outside involvement by the legislature, by the Ombudsman for Mental Health, by others, by one means or another, is really needed, because I think other people will bring a very different perspective on conflicts of interest and ethical issues.
I'll defer my question. Okay. I think some of my questions will be answered by the next presentation.
Okay. Mr. Nobles, Ms. Sawicki, again, thank you very much for your work. And now we'll hear from the Senate faculty panel, and then we'll move to the folks from the administration.
Chair Bonhoff and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to discuss with you the recently completed external review of the Human Subjects Research Protection Program at the University of Minnesota. Today, I'll describe the process.
Could you please say your name for the record?
My name is Will Durfee, and I'm a faculty member at the University of Minnesota, and I'll describe myself more fully in about 30 seconds.
Oh, sorry.
So I'm going to describe the process that led the faculty to call for the review. I'm going to describe how the review was conducted, and then I'll summarize some of the key findings and key recommendations of the report produced by the external review panel. So let me explain who I am. My name is Will Durfee, and I'm professor and director of design education in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Minnesota. My research area is medical devices, more specifically devices related to rehabilitation. Among other projects, I work on machines that enable individuals paralyzed due to spinal cord injury to walk, and devices that enable those recovering from stroke to conduct targeted rehabilitation at home. My research is funded through the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Much of my research involves human subjects, and I'm familiar with the principles of human subjects research, including the principles of informed consent. While I have knowledge of research with human subjects, I'll now explain why I'm the one presenting the report to you. The reason is that during the academic year 2013-2014, I was chair of the Faculty Consultative Committee, or FCC, and the process I'm about to describe to you started in fall 2013 when I was chair. FCC is the elected executive committee of the University Faculty Senate, which in turn is the elective body of faculty that handles academic policies and procedures, as well as other matters related to university faculty. I'm still on the FCC, but no longer chair. The current FCC chair is my colleague, Rebecca Ropers-Hillman, who's sitting in the audience to my left. From fall 2013 until now, I've been the lead faculty representative in this matter, thus it's appropriate that I'm the one presenting to you today. Now I'll describe the process that led to the inquiry. As you've just heard from the legislative auditor, in May 2004, Dan Markinson, while enrolled in a clinical trial of an antipsychotic drug at the University of Minnesota, committed suicide. And since then, individuals and groups within and outside the university have raised questions about the study, how Markinson was recruited to participate as a subject, his treatment during the study and the circumstance of his suicide. In October 2013, a letter co-authored by six bioethicists from outside the university with 175 co-signatories was sent to President Kaler and to members of the Faculty Senate at the university. The letter asked the Faculty Senate to endorse and request an independent investigation of issues arising from the Markison case and the CAFE study you just heard about. In November 2013, 14 faculty senators co-signed a request to the FCC calling for the Faculty Senate resolution on initiating an independent investigation of the Markison case. The FCC, as the executive committee of the faculty, discussed the letters and requests at several meetings back in 2013, and members of FCC, as well as members of the Faculty Senate, had and still have a range of views on whether to call for an investigation of the Markison case. What emerged, however, from our discussion was a consensus, while that some investigations had been conducted on the Markison case, those investigations did not address the broader question of whether the university's current policies, procedures, and practices reflects best practice in clinical research on human subjects and the faculty's high ambitions for ethical behavior. Therefore, the FCC in 2013 decided the way forward was to bring to the Senate a resolution calling for an independent and transparent examination to evaluate the university's procedures, practices, and policies governing clinical research on human subjects. Of particular interest to all university faculty, not just those who conduct research with human subjects, was the reputation of the university and desire to ensure through independent evaluation that the university's ethical standards for clinical research on human subjects met or surpassed the norm. In December of 2013, a resolution crafted by FCC was debated by the University Faculty Senate and passed 67-4 and 23 against. The resolution called for an inquiry examining current policies, practices, and oversight of clinical research on human subjects at the university, and in particular, clinical research involving adult participants with diminished functional abilities. It asked that the administration, in collaboration with faculty, initiate the constitution of the panel to conduct the review and to support its inquiry. It called for the panel at the end of the review to deliver a report that would make public and that the panel would present its findings before the faculty. President Kaler accepted and supported the resolution and in January 2014 charged Brian Herman, Vice President for Research, with implementing the resolution in collaboration with faculty. In his charge letter, President Kaler stated that the purpose of the review was to ensure that the university's human subjects protection program meets or exceeds established best practices and to instill confidence that the university research is, quote, beyond reproach, end quote. In other words, the request was that the panel have a high bar in conducting its review. Charge letter also stressed that the review be independent and not influenced by the university. I was the faculty representative who collaborated with Vice President Herman on setting up the review. In February 2014, an RFP was issued for contractors to manage the review process, and in June of 2014, a contract was signed with the Association for the Accreditation of Human Research Protection Programs, or AHRP, to manage the review. It's important to note that while AHRP recruited the six experts to conduct the review, the experts are not AHRP employees, and AHRP was not involved in the review itself, had no access to the panel's deliberations, communications, or report drafts. It's also important to note the review panel had no further instructions other than the charge given in the RFP, which was identical to the charge given by President Kaler for the review, which in turn is largely quoted from the Faculty Senate resolution. Now I'll briefly describe the process the panel undertook to conduct its review. It conducted its work from August 2014 to March 2015. It requested and received hundreds of documents from the university related to its human subjects protection program. It conducted a two-day site visit to the University of Minnesota in September of 2014 and interviewed 53 people. The choice of which documents to review and which people to interview was completely determined by the panel. It also arranged for an anonymous survey of current and former research subjects, and in addition received unsolicited comments from stakeholders inside and outside the university through a confidential email account, as well as stakeholders who contacted the panel members directly. Throughout the process, Vice President Herman and I kept our distance as we both wished to ensure that the panel had complete freedom to operate without influence from the university. The panel issued its final report, which is dated February 23rd of this year, and the report was made public immediately after it was delivered. Finally, two panel members appeared at a two-hour Faculty Senate meeting on March 6th, just a couple of weeks ago, to present their findings and to answer questions from faculty senators. That meeting was also open to the public, and a video has been posted publicly online for anyone who was not able to attend. So let me now summarize some of the main findings and recommendations of the report. The full report is 92 pages and it has 63 recommendations. I strongly recommend that anyone with an interest in this matter read the report in its entirety, as any brief summary, including the one I'm about to give, or media excerpt, cannot provide the full context. Some of the report contains subject matter that requires some expertise in human subjects protection to fully understand, and the references cited in the report are suggested for background knowledge. Two main themes are evident in the report. The first is that there's many strengths in the university's current human subjects program, including newly implemented changes in policy and practice, and the report commends faculty and staff who demonstrate pride in their work, dedication to the ethical conduct of research, and a desire to improve performance. The second theme is while the university's program may meet minimum regulatory and accreditation thresholds for the protection of human subjects, there's a significant gap between that minimum and a human subject protection program that meets or exceeds the current standards of best practice for ethical conduct of research. Specifically, the panel recommended improvements in IRB review process, greater attention to investigator education, and improved practices related to informed consent. The panel recommended that there be additional documentation of IRB discussion and decisions. They suggested that additional subject matter experts be present during IRP review of protocols, particularly protocols where the ability to consent comes into play. They recommended additional investigator training, in particular advanced training in the ethics of using research subjects who may have impaired decision-making capacity, and advanced training for investigators whose research protocols are found to be in serious noncompliance with policy. They suggested improved process related to post-approval monitoring of studies, including tracking subjects during the conduct of a study and processes for ensuring protection of subjects with impaired decision-making capacity during the course of research participation. They recommended that we look at renewed look at our conflict of interest policies, particularly related to drug studies that are funded by outside entities. They recommended that for patients who are research subjects, clinical care staff and others who are independent of the research team be involved in decisions about whether a research subject should continue in the study. They recommended that there be better engagement with research subjects and to establish mutually beneficial and respectful relationships with community members to ensure that the voice of research subjects is heard to advance the ethical conduct of research. They recommended that additional attention be paid to policies on who may serve as a legally authorized representative for subjects who lack capacity to consent. They made several recommendations related to a relatively small but absolutely significant portfolio of research projects in the Department of Psychiatry, which included continuing attention to the evolving relationship between psychiatry research and psychiatry clinical priorities in the Fairview Health Systems. And finally, the panel recommended that the university place a high priority on its human subjects protection program and to move as a university towards a culture where examination and feedback is welcomed and where all university stakeholders work together to attain a program of the highest quality that embodies the highest ethical values. Before concluding, I would like to make four observations. First, as the report notes and as the panel members reiterated at their March 6th Faculty Senate meeting, their findings and recommendations were not designed to determine whether the university met a minimum bar, but rather to determine if the university had a human subjects program that was, in the word of President Kaler's charge, quote, beyond reproach, end quote. The panel concluded that we were not at that level, but provided us with a path for how to get there. Second, while not in the report, panel members stated that they were impressed that the university chose to make the examination of its program transparent and public. In my view, this is compatible with our mission as a public university, and because the document is public, this report will be used by research subject protection programs around the country, which means the University of Minnesota is doing a service not only to itself, but universities across the United States. Third, the recommendations in the report are reasonable and will be considered seriously and carefully. And it's my opinion that embracing the recommendations in the report, those working at or connected to the university, including myself, hope that our university becomes an institution whose human research protection program becomes a model for the world to respect and to follow. Fourth and finally, the processes of the inquiry was a collaborative effort between faculty, staff, and administration, and that collaborative process will continue as we proceed to implement the recommendations in the report. Chair Bonoff, from members of the committee, that concludes my comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Durfee. Questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Durfee. Something kind of interesting that you said that touched a note with me. Your report is more forward-looking. When you look at the ethical aspects in finding three of the legislative auditor's report, that there were concerns expressed and that there was a sense that those concerns weren't acted upon in a way, are you convinced now that procedurally changes and or from a policy standpoint, changes are in place now to make sure that we do, in fact, have an adequate process to follow up on those? Because we're talking about, as Mr. Noble said, a vulnerable adult, and even though he's of age majority, may not have at the time he was making his decision had his full faculties of him. So,
Madam Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I think the report that I was presenting on is forward-looking. I think it's important to note that at the University of Minnesota, there are currently somewhere near 11,000 research protocols involving human subjects. Of those, a little under half involve medical protocols. Of those, a small percentage involve vulnerable subjects. I think what the panel did that resulted in the report that I just described was to focus particularly on those protocols and procedures and processes and ethics involving protocols with subjects with impaired decision-making capacity. I think that the recommendations in that report do provide a step forward so that we can reach that best practice, particularly the ethical standards that I think all of us in this room and around the state think is necessary. If you look at the credentials of the people who conducted the review, in my view, they are impeccable. They are this is a changing field about what ethical practice is, and the norms of 30 years ago are different than the norms now. This is was a panel who are absolutely on top of current norms, and I think pointed us to a way where we can reach those norms.
Mr. Durfee, you spoke of your relationship in this process with Vice President Herman. It sounds like, in a way, that you two worked very collaboratively and in partnership to make sure you got to the best result. Do you want to say anything about that?
Chair Bonoff, thank you for the question. I think the sense I was the faculty representative and the sense of the faculty at the University of Minnesota was really three things. One is that the report be independent. Two is that it was up to the panel to decide what to investigate based on the faculty's interest in being involved with a university that could attain the highest reputation. I think there's just those were really the two main points. And so myself as a faculty representative, that's where I was engaged with the process in attempting to make sure that the faculty voice was heard. Vice President Herman, as a representative of administration, had absolutely consistent views. And so nowhere in the process, in my sense, was there any conflict between what the faculty desired and what the administration desired through Vice President Herman in this independent review.
Thank you. I have one kind of strange question, and that has to do with your starting remarks. You said there were 64 votes for and 23 against doing the review, and I wondered if you could just tell us what the dissension was. Was that the fact that you were going to be just forward-looking and not a closer look at the Markinson case, or was it that those who were against it didn't feel as though that was something they wanted to focus on?
Chair Balanoff, I cannot speak for all of the people who voted against or all the people who voted for, because not all expressed views orally. I think there were two main themes. One is faculty who were interested in having an additional explicit review of the Markinson case. I think the other were faculty who felt that that our IRB processes, in fact, were adequate. They were appropriate, and felt that an additional outside review was not appropriate at that time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the things that Mr. Nobles pointed out in his presentation was that in the case of the IRB's review of the Markinson case was that the extent of the review was a one-page submission by Dr. Olson himself. And so without sort of rehashing history, do you believe that the recommendations that are here are strong enough to make sure that a review would be more thorough and independent than happened in that case?
Chair Bonner, Senator Kent, one of the sections in the reports has to do with post-review monitoring of studies, and that would include things like serious adverse events, which is the term that's used in the art for things even as serious as suicide. And the report does come out with several recommendations. I don't remember how many, in terms of new ways to examine and handle serious adverse events.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to need some time to review this report, but I just wanted to encourage the members to really reflect on a couple of issues, I think, that have been said. One is that I think President Keller has been said that we have, the instruction was to conduct a review of the Human Research Protection Program to make sure that it's beyond reproach. And I think that's a pretty strong statement. And I also believe that it's obviously in the best interest of these scientists to have a system that is beyond reproach. And so I very much hope that we review this report. There's a lot of expertise, I presume, in this report. And I want to read it very carefully. I am obviously very appreciative of the review of the auditor, and I am appreciative of the time that they've taken. But I am going to read this report more carefully, because I believe that the expertise and the amount of time that went into this review is something that I want to really be able to see, you know, what is the work that it was done. So I don't want to continue to push this committee into a review without having the expertise. So I just wanted to say thank you for this review. Thank you for spending the time to give us the advice that we need to make informed decisions about this issue. This is about human lives. And I'm very appreciative of the university's approach and steps towards bringing us real expertise to make these decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, for expressing that for all of us. And it is our intent to revisit this after break so that we can come back more thoughtfully to talk about a legislative proposal in response to the report, and rather than react today. So thank you very much. I think unless you have anything else, we'll hear from President Kaler and whoever President Kaler chooses to bring with right now, perhaps Regent Simmons.
Excuse me.
Thank you, President Kaler. I'm sure listening to both reports is not easy to sit back there and not be able to jump in and express what I'm sure you must be thinking and feeling as we gather around this table. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chair Bonner. I'm joined here today by members of our Board of Regents as an indication of how seriously we're taking this. Regent Tom Anderson is here, Regent Linda Cohen, Regent Michael Hsu, Regent Peggy Lucas, Regent Darren Rocha, and Regent Abdul Omari are here. And at the table with me is Regent Patricia Simmons, former chair of the board, as is Regent Cohen. And Dr. Stephen Olson is also here in the audience. Senator Bonhoff and members of the committee, as I hope you know, for the past nearly 4 years as president, I prided myself in leading a University of Minnesota that is accountable, transparent, ethical, and driven by integrity. And with that in mind, I want to thank Mr. Nobles for his work and his assessment. As you know, the legislative auditor focused on the events surrounding the 2004 death of Dan Markinson while he was enrolled in a clinical trial at our university. Earlier this month, you've just heard another report from an external, independent panel of experts focused on current practices in our human subjects research program, particularly as it relates to the very complex issue of working with people with diminished decision-making capabilities. And both reports have concluded that while many strive to be the very best, in some areas of our program, we have fallen short. We take these findings seriously, and we are prepared to address them and move forward as an improved research university. Let me begin by expressing our deepest sympathy to Dan Markinson's mother, Mrs. Weiss, and her family, and to apologize to her for his death while under our care. The loss of Dan Markinson's life was a terrible tragedy. I cannot imagine the pain his mother and those closest to him felt and continue to feel. I know his care team was profoundly saddened by his death. Our doctors, nurses, researchers, and leaders do this work because we are dedicated to finding cures and treatments for the most pressing diseases that affect our citizens. In seeking those cures and treatments, we must protect patients who entrust us with their care. And to that end, today we are reaffirming and reinforcing our commitment to protect our patients with immediate action. In consultation with and oversight from our Board of Regents, here is some of what we are going to do. First, we have suspended enrollment in all Department of Psychiatry interventional drug studies, those that are active or awaiting approval, until they are reviewed by an independent institutional review board. Second, we created a task force to plan the implementation of the external panel review recommendations and charged it to report action items and a plan and timeline to me by May 15th, fewer than 60 days from now. Third, we are engaging an independent institutional review board to work with the U's post-approval monitoring process to examine other clinical studies that target vulnerable populations and to ensure they are meeting best practices. Fourth, we will appoint a community oversight board of external experts in human subjects research and research ethics to ensure we are using best practices. These actions, along with others we are already taking, will provide a level of oversight consistent with the combination of recommendations from the external review panel and the legislative auditor. Most importantly, we hold ourselves responsible and accountable, and we will have robust oversight and monitoring by the Board of Regents. Madam Chair, as you stated in your opening statement, I too was told of Mr. Markinson's case as I came to the university in 2011. When I reviewed the documents related to that case, I relied on the findings of the FDA, the Board of Medical Practice, and the courts. I did that because those are the bodies in the United States that are responsible for finding facts and resolving issues in matters such as these. Mr. Nobles has found reasons to be concerned about those findings, particularly the Board of Medical Practice, with regard to how Mr. Markinson provided consent to take part in the clinical study. Mr. Nobles also found fault with our institutional review board. While the IRB did carry out a minimal review, in hindsight, the IRB should have investigated more thoroughly at the time. And to the extent that the U's subsequent descriptions of what the IRB did has been misleading, I apologize. While we disagree with some of Mr. Noble's findings, we must get better in caring for our most vulnerable patients. We have accepted the recent report from the external panel that offers many recommendations for improvement. Doing that is Mr. Noble's first recommendation, and we are committed to taking those actions as we work to strengthen our patients and your trust in us. In closing, as we care for patients and their families and as we advance knowledge about human health, we must hold ourselves to the highest ethical standards. I deeply regret that we have not always lived up to Minnesotans' expectations. I invite all of you in this committee and Legislative Auditor Nobles to visit our campus over the coming months to evaluate how we're doing. We cannot change the past, but we can, with vigilance, dedication, and integrity, move forward. And we will ensure that the research we conduct occurs in the safest and most ethical way possible. I pledge to you that we will work tirelessly to restore confidence in our actions as researchers and care providers. And I promise you and our future patients and their families that the University of Minnesota's Human Subjects Research Program will one day be a model for other universities, and one is that is beyond reproach. Minnesotans expect and our patients deserve no less. With that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I thank you. And with your permission, before I take your questions, I'd like to introduce Dr. Patricia Simmons, a member of the university's Board of Regents. And I'd then like to invite our Vice President for Health Sciences and the Dean of our Medical School, Dr. Brooks Jackson, and our Vice President for Research, Dr. Brian Herman, to join us for questions after Regent Simmons' testimony.
Thank you very much, President Kaler. Regent Simmons.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. I am Patricia Simmons. I'm a member of the University of Minnesota's Board of Regents and a recently retired Mayo Clinic physician, medical scientist, and executive. You, the legislature, elected me because of what I can bring to governance of the university. I am a pediatrician who took care of some of our most vulnerable patients, children and adolescents. Early in my career, I realized that we did not know enough about diseases and their treatments to take care of our patients, and that was because of inadequate research. So I became a medical researcher as well as a physician in order to help find some of the answers that we need. I care deeply about patients, especially our most vulnerable patients, and I'm passionate about having knowledge and creating knowledge to improve and save lives. My heart goes out to Mr. Markinson's family and friends and the physicians and nurses and social workers who tried to help him. This tragic loss provokes in me not only sympathy, but a call to action. As an academic physician and clinical researcher, I understand firsthand the complexity as well as the importance of doing medical studies to truly help people with illnesses. I bring years of expertise and great empathy to this issue. When I retired from Mayo Clinic on December 22nd, as a Board of Regents member, I became unfettered by conflict of interest. Like the president, I began my own examination, reviewing the legal decisions, the agency investigations, and external reviews of the Markinson case. In addition to bringing my own experience in medical care and research to the concerns, I consulted external medical researchers and began a review of relevant medical literature on clinical trials in psychiatry. I agree with the legislative auditor, the district court, and the Food and Drug Administration that I cannot conclude that Mr. Markinson's death was a result of the clinical study in which he was enrolled. A study to try to find better treatment from such a devastating disease. I know from my long years of experience at Mayo that very sadly, patients die during clinical trials. They die because we do not have the treatments that work for all suffering patients. Sometimes a clinical trial is their best or only hope. That is why we do medical research to find cures and treatments that work. I also fully agree that improvements must and will be made in our Human Subjects Research Program at the university. At the request of the Chair of the Board of Regents, I'm leading our board on this commitment to see that deficiencies are acknowledged and improvements are made. The chair and I are working directly with the president on the immediate and longer-term actions to make those improvements. I would like to point out that Professor Durfee's report of the resolution from the Faculty Senate, the Faculty Senate is chaired by President Kaler, so he was part of that request. Our actions reflect our deep commitment to ethical, the highest ethical human subjects research program that is beyond reproach. I do not agree with the legislative auditor's conclusion from the retrospective review that the university should not have accepted the FDA, the district court, conclusions. I do not believe it is appropriate for the university to decide to selectively reject the authority of these expert bodies whose responsibility it is to examine issues like this. We have to have our regulatory bodies. We have to adhere to them, or this institution, like all the others, would be adrift without necessary oversight. May I please address an assertion in the legislative auditor's report that the Board of Regents has not conducted a public meeting on the Markinson case. While it is true that there was never a public meeting of the full board, in a 7-page letter to Mr. Nobles dated March 5th of this year, we detailed for him years' worth of briefings between the board members and the responsible university officials, including the president. The auditor was told of the policy changes and external reviews that came before by the board of director of our office. The board was not uninformed or uneducated about these issues and took the governance role seriously. In addition, since Mr. Markinson's death, the university twice received full reaccreditation of its human subjects research programs in 2007 and 10 by AHARP. Madam Chair, on December 22nd, I retired from the staff of the Mayo Clinic. Until then, I recused myself from Board of Regents' decisions on university medical school matters because my employer then is considered a competitor. At the Board of Regents, we take conflict of interest seriously, and my relationship posed a conflict that had to be managed by recusal and distancing me from these issues in the medical school. Now that I am free of such conflicts, I have and will continue to insist on the highest standard for the university in medical research, which includes ethics that are impeccable. That includes oversight to ensure that the functions and the quality of the IRBs, of the physicians and researchers, and of university leadership at every level, including the regents. Since my retirement from Mayo Clinic, President Kaler and I have been identifying improvements we insist need to be made to our human subjects research enterprise. The president outlined some of these actions in his remarks, and next week, the Board of Regents will discuss them, and I'm certain approve them. With Board Chair Rick Beeson and the rest of my colleagues, I'm committed to not only close oversight, but direct involvement. Chair Beeson and I have proposed a plan for board monitoring of human subjects protection. We have and will continue to set expectations on internal performance and insist on external membership, not only on the IRB, but also on the oversight body for the entire clinical studies program. These members, these external members, will not only be responsible and respected citizens, but will have the expertise needed to make meaningful assessments. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the regents are accountable to the people of Minnesota. We ask that we, like the president, come back to you and share with you the progress on achieving the demands for improvements in medical research at the university. As a physician whose career has been devoted to the best care I can give and to research of the highest ethical standard to improve and save more lives, along with my fellow regents, we will also be accountable to the public and, so very importantly, to the university's most vulnerable patients. Thank you.
President Kaler, before the others come up, I might just address a couple things with Regent Simmons, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Please.
Regent Simmons, you mentioned your disagreement with legislative auditor Nobles with regard to not taking into a serious account the FDA report and the district court findings. So my first question to you is, do you think that when the general counsel of the university told the legislature and spoke publicly as he talked about how this matter had been reviewed and had referred to an IRB report having been done and an attorney general's review having been done, do you think that that was did you believe there was actually a full review by the IRB at that point?
Madam Chair, I do not believe that an adequate review was done at the level of the IRB. It was a review, not an investigation. I think there's been confusion about just what was done. There was an FDA investigation and review, however, because of the serious adverse event. And I think it's very good to hear what was in that FDA investigation. It's very useful, and Dean Jackson, you may wish to have him share that. I believe that more must be done. IRBs have a sacred trust. There's a reason that they have external members, is to try to add that additional level of protection. They have to be highly functional, and we're going to see that we have it, and if we don't, we're going to use external IRBs.
And Regent Simmons, with regard to the court findings, what I read was that the court, in fact, ruled that there was immunity with regard to the university rather than a full review of the case.
Actually, Madam Chair, there is more complexity to what the district court said, as I understand it. And as I understand from reading this, the district court did say that consent was appropriately obtained.
Regent Simmons, I too have read that, but the remarks that the district court ruled that the matter had been found upon review, that no wrongdoing had happened, in fact, was never a finding, correct? There was the finding about consent as well as that they were immune from any further charges.
Madam Chair, one component was about the interview, the university itself and the Board of Regents, or that's who gets sued for the university. There was immunity on that piece of it, but there was a statement about the consent.
And so I bring this up because I really appreciated President Kaler's remarks, and I appreciate the tone, and I do trust the leadership of President Kaler and the regents. But I did read that letter that Chair Beeson sent, and to me it was a little bit like more of what we had already been hearing, because it pointed to things that we have fully reviewed and found inadequate. So I do appreciate your commitment to take this on and bring the wide breadth of expertise that you bring like nobody else does. And I think that we will be well served for that. But I would hope that we would, be also clear about what went wrong prior to this.
Madam Chair, may I please say, I want to make it clear, I'm not satisfied with what happened.
Thank you.
The president isn't satisfied. I'm not satisfied. We're pretty motivated here.
and I know that to be true, but I did want to clarify on the record for that.
Thank you.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, President Kaler and Regent Simmons, for being here on this issue. Listening to your testimony and maybe following up with Chair Bonoff, President Kaler, you mentioned you relied on some sources, the IRB one-page report. I assume that's the extent of that evaluation, the medical practice board process, and the courts back in 2011 when you first were delving into this issue, informing yourself about the Markinson case. Yet when we talk about the report we have in front of us with the findings of Mr. Noble's office, you mentioned you have several disagreements, and I know we have an extra packet and I'll delve into that in more detail, but from my perspective, it is an independent, unbiased review as well that's looking at all these factors, probably more depth than each of them individually. after that deep investigation, you still find some areas of disagreement. Why is that?
Chair Bonoff, Senator Franzen.
President Kaler.
My goal here is not to debate the legislative auditor's findings, but there are other elements that he examined. He arrived at a different conclusion about those elements than I did. And he and I have not had an opportunity in the compressed time frame of delivering this report to have a full, candid discussion about it. But I accept his report. We certainly fell short in the area of IRB review, and we certainly followed a process of consenting that individual that was subsequently found to be inappropriate in a law passed prevented in 2009.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to call your other
If I may,
members to the
call
table.
A couple of friends to the table. I'll introduce to you Vice President Brian Herman and Vice President and Dean of the Medical School, Brooks Jackson. They are both relatively new to the University of Minnesota. They bring extremely strong credentials, and both have experience in human clinical trials, which I believe will be relevant to questions, to responding to questions that the committee may have. So we're open for your questions.
Members, questions? I always have questions. Dr. Jackson, upon reading both the Senate faculty report and the Office of Legislative Auditor's report, and given your background and experience at Johns Hopkins, what are your thoughts about what you've read and heard here today?
Thank you, Senator Bonham, for the opportunity to respond. Just briefly, I'm a newcomer in this past year to the University of Minnesota, although I was here in the 80s. My background, I have extensive experience as a principal investigator of clinical trials over 30 years in vulnerable populations, including children and adults with diminished mental capacity. And I do know the Code of Federal Regulations extremely well and the guidance for clinical practice. I'm also a chair of one of the FDA advisory committees that recommends licensure of drugs and biologics for Minnesotans and the rest of the country. So I'm very familiar with the processes and the reports that we rely on to make these decisions. First, let me just say that I am very supportive of these recommendations. I do think, one, we do want to have the best practices that are beyond reproach. This particular area is a very difficult area to be sure that we have issues of conflict of interest dealt with, consent issues. Anyone with diminished mental capacity, no matter how careful you are, there is always still the concern. It could just, even just perception, that there's a problem. It's easy to see, I think, in reviewing. When I first came, I did not know about the Markinson case until I came here last year. But I did review the documents, the FDA audit report, for example, which this was a four-cause audit report with a number of allegations, including the ability of Dan Markinson to consent is one of the issues. This was a investigation by the FDA where they spent eight full days looking at these issues. And, you know, I can read the bottom line here, and I'll quote from the FDA audit after all this review. Quote, I did not find any evidence of misconduct, significant violation of the protocol or regulations governing clinical investigators or institutional review boards in this inspection, data audit, or interviews. Now, I know people, you know, view this as a floor or sort of the minimal standards. It is a floor. Having said that, it does set these Code of Federal Regulations, which are based on the ethical standards of the United States, do set, in many ways, the best standards in the world. So you can see why the leadership, the past presidents, the past deans, when you read this, as a FDA chair of a committee, we really take these extremely seriously because these truly are experts. Now, having said that, there is not as much guidance as there should be in this area in the Code of Federal Regulations. So there is plenty of opportunity to do better. And I think this external report really guides us in how to do that better. In the past year, President Herman and I have already taken steps. We've, I think, doubled or tripled the number of internal auditors in terms for post-approval review to make sure that investigators are adhering to these protocols and that consent is being properly obtained. There are a number of things that have, in terms of new hires, to look at this internally. Now we're going to do more externally. So, you know, in general, I'm very supportive of this, but I want to make it clear to me why I think our leadership in the past, viewing the courts, these audits, why you might come to those conclusions, especially when that's not your area of expertise, and we do rely on them. There is one finding I do want to bring up because you're considering legislation that's in the auditor's report, and that's the conflict of interest issue. And Senator Nelson had a question about why would he be randomizing this. But on the conflict of interest, Dr. Olson, who is here and can answer questions as well, did not personally have any financial conflict of interest in this, and that he personally received no money. The auditor, Mr. Nobles, specifically is critical of the fact that the university was reimbursed on a per-subject enrolled basis. This is standard across the United States, not just for drug studies, but all our federal studies, the NIH studies. I have done over 100. Reimbursement is linked to enrollment. Enrollment costs more money. Sometimes it's on a per-subject. Sometimes if you meet certain numbers. And I don't, you know, if you pass legislation that says you can't do that, we will not be able to do clinical trials. What we need to do is, despite that, minimize that conflict of interest as much as possible. And I think the recommendations, which do not include that issue about reimbursement on enrollment, how can we minimize that conflict? So I think it does address that, but I would be very worried about saying you can't do that because we just won't be able to do research. That'll be very difficult. The one issue, I think it was Senator Nelson that brought up about why would you randomize somebody who's on a treatment?
Senator Sharon.
So in this case, I mean, Dan Markinson was randomized to three licensed drugs that have equivalent efficacy, but they do have different side effects, for example. And we always want to learn more. This is a very bad disease, schizophrenia. 20% to 40% of schizophrenics attempt suicide. 5% to 15% succeed in suicide. He was given, you know, standard licensed drugs, but there are differences in side effects that can affect adherence to the drug, whether you take the drug, and that's extremely important. Patients who don't take their drugs, schizophrenia in particular, have a 5 times greater rate of rehospitalization. Being in a study, you're monitored much more frequently and longer visits. You know, I think there are tremendous benefits. Now, you could say that's coercive because you do, in many ways, get better care being part of a study. But in this case, he would have received, in my opinion, better care being in the study than not. So just to give you an idea of why these studies are sometimes done this way.
Dr. Jackson, do doctors who participate in these studies also sometimes consult for the pharmaceutical company? So, for example, AstraZeneca?
They do. They do. And, you know, I personally do not take any drug company money or any money from companies because of the perception of the conflict of interest. The federal regulations do actually allow you to do that and still be a principal investigator if you manage the conflict of interest. This is my personal opinion. I know we're considering this, that I believe protocol chairs should not take any, have any personal financial interest in the drug being evaluated in studies involving vulnerable populations. That's my opinion, and that's a personal opinion, but...
Dr. Jackson, do you know if the psychiatric chair and other in that department, Dr. Olson, for example, were employed as consultants in any capacity?
Well, Dr. Olson was not receiving, did not have a financial conflict of interest on this particular study.
I didn't ask that question, though.
I'm sorry.
Whether or not they have been consultants for the pharmaceutical companies?
I believe I know Dr. Schultz has. I'm not sure about Dr. Olson. But as I said, my opinion on this is that you should not do this with a company that you're evaluating their drug for.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. Okay. Good. Any other questions for Dr. Jackson before we hear from Vice President Herman? Senator Sharon, you're good?
Well, I am not certain how to articulate what it is that I'm reacting to, but I find it very difficult to come to a place where I feel confidence that the change will occur that will improve the outcomes of how we deal with human trials on humans when we go back to in relationship to what the federal government says we can or cannot do in terms of accepting payment from pharmaceutical companies. You know, nobody's told us that it's not okay to do this, so we're not violating anything that's established at a federal level. And in the review process, I'm sure that that's sort of the standard possibly that was used. And that concerns me, that we have a justification about a failure to really do due diligence, I think, in this matter on that basis. And that's what I'm hearing. And if that is what's being said, and maybe that's not what's being said, then I think the question in the auditor's report about leadership is a fair question. And in this report, the faculty report about the culture that exists, whether or not that, in fact, is going to change. I don't know if I have confidence from what I'm hearing about that.
President Kaler.
Thank you, Chair Bonhoff, Senator Sharon. You are right to be concerned. I am also concerned. And that's why we will have a plan by May 15th, and we will lay out how we achieve the goals in the report from the external panel. Those goals aren't designed to make us be okay. Those are designed to have us have the best program in the country, one that is beyond reproach, which is a word that I use frequently. And we will do that, and we will do it in a clear and transparent way. We will have an external oversight committee. And we'll report to the board. One thing that's important, one of many things that's important in this conversation, is the management of conflict of interest. Conflict of interest in many scientific or medical endeavors is inherent. You cannot get rid of it. But you can manage it in a way that is open and transparent. For example, receiving a consulting fee from a company for which you're doing a drug test looks like a really bad idea. And in fact, one of the recommendations that may come from our group is that we prohibit that at the University of Minnesota. But if you declare that you have a conflict of interest and you provide financial data to the institutional officer who manages that conflict of interest, and you do something with that money you receive as a consultant, such as donate it to the university for a scholarship, you can manage that conflict of interest. But we need the best, brightest, clearest lines around that problem that exist in the country. We do not have them now, but we will have them as we go forward.
May I just... Senator Sharon.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate... I was trying to remember the dates on this 2013-2014 when this was occurring, around conflict of interest that we're talking about. I know, and I was fairly new to the legislature at the time, there were a number of initiatives in the health and Human Services Policy Committee about just the very thing that you're talking about. There were initiatives at the legislative level to stop the practice of allowing physicians to receive consultation fees from drug companies because of the implications it had, if not managed conflict, a perceived conflict, and one that we simply were having. The university was very, very aggressive in stopping that legislation. And the discussion about the per unit payment from the drug companies and the inherent conflict that is in that, about the university's dependence on these resources for its research. So how can a university that is dependent on this resource for its research be asked to review its conflict of interest policy and make recommendations to it about how to approach a conflict of interest? I don't think when there's that inherent conflict that you can rely on the university to make a decision that's really, really in the best interest of the subjects that you are using in these trials.
Sure.
I'm just concerned that we're going to get the same outcome, which is don't do anything to change our financial interests and needs. You know, I believe it's in part because we don't provide enough research dollars to the university. You have to go someplace else look for the money.
President Kaler, I think everybody at the table wants to address this one, so we'll start with the president and then move from there.
We'll pass it around, and I'll be brief because I don't know that I have a lot to add, Chair Bonhoeff and Senator Sharon. We will bring the best views and best models from other places. We're not going to sit by ourselves in Minneapolis and figure out what's in our own best interest. We will look deeply and carefully at this problem, and we will have a best practice.
I should note also that I have learned that we actually recruited Dr. Jackson to here because of his experience in this area. So I think that we are very fortunate to be joined at the table by somebody who this really is, one of the finest in this field. And so when you say that you don't appreciate that conflict, having somebody both get a consulting fee from the pharmaceutical company and participates in the research, we agree with you, and so we hope we'll see that policy soon.
Can I make...
Yes.
Senator, just to... maybe we can spend more time later, but, you know, one of the things, a way to manage that, trials cost money, so the university does need... The more you do, you will get reimbursed more. I think the key is that the salary for the investigator who does these studies, that won't vary. Their compensation will not be affected by whether they enroll 100 or 10. Clearly, these are costs. They're not margins on these things. You have to pay for the lab tests and the radiology and that sort of thing. I think, too, the disclosure is important, making sure even subjects know that, this is a study that, we do get reimbursed by the federal government or the state potentially, or even the drug companies. For the more we enroll, the university will get more resources. So there are a number of ways to try to minimize that and make that as transparent as possible. And I'm all for doing that. But it is an issue because if you don't have these trials, our patients, people of Minnesota, won't have access to the latest life-saving experimental drugs, vaccines, that sort of thing. I mean, we have to be able to figure out how to do this.
Senator Sharon.
I understand the problem of the financing. But in the case, of course, I don't know the details of the case, but I was struck by the fact that, at least based on what I've understood, whether this is true or not in this case, if this is true in general, you have a patient that is doing well on a given treatment, and we are managing a psychosis on a treatment. And there's a conversation about trying to get a number of subjects into a clinical trial. And there's nobody there telling this person, you're doing well on your medication. I can't really see... whether or not the risk is good for you. Where is that advocacy in this process and in the future process that we make sure that when this... Because physicians, believe it or not for all of you, who are physicians, by the general public are seen as omniscient in many ways. And if you suggest something to the general public, they're going to say, oh, this is in my best interest. I might get better treatment if I go over here than there. They might not know I'm going to be taken off my medication that I'm doing pretty well on and getting better on and being put on something that may or may not respond to me as well. So, you know, this is about the fact that we have human subjects and that we have a university system that's seeking resources to do good research, to do things better in the long term for people. But where is there the balance of power in this?
So in these recommendations by the external review, I think does address some of these concerns you have, and that in terms of the advocacy, in terms of the external individuals who will be present when these discussions take place and can make recommendations. In this particular trial, you know, obviously there were 25 other sites and 25 other IRBs who considered these issues about whether they were on medication or not. So, you know, I don't know all that went into those decisions. I, you know, obviously was not part of that trial. Dr. Olson is here. You can ask him. But I agree with you that, you know, we need as many safeguards as possible for these vulnerable populations. So when these issues come up, why, you know, when you ask, is it ethical to take them off and put them on three other drugs, even though they've been shown to be efficacious, that's a legitimate concern. And we should have mechanisms in place to make sure those types of things are addressed.
Regent Simmons.
Thank you, Chair Bonhoff. And Senator Sharon, I wanted to comment, too, because I do not believe it's ethical to take someone who's doing well on a treatment and move them into a study where you don't know how well they're due to find out. So that is not an ethical practice, number one. I feel strongly about it. That is a standard that I would expect us to have. I don't know about this situation, so I'm not commenting on it. I do know that you do sometimes have a patient on a treatment plan, a drug, who does well for a while, but you know you're at high risk of them discontinuing that drug because of side effects over the long term. So sometimes you look for an alternative, even though they're doing well right now. I do not know. I'm not commenting about the case that we're talking about, but that does happen sometimes where you look for that better drug that's going to work for them, and they'll stay on it longer.
And I appreciate that. I just think in this instance, we didn't know what the drugs were, and we didn't have that information. This was a blind, and so there has to be somebody who's able to who doesn't have a conflict of interest, isn't getting paid, isn't part of the university system that knows that the university needs that money for its research, to take a look at and be an informed person about the treatment of whatever this, psychiatry or any of the other areas, that they have a chance of really knowing who their advocate is and that it's good, solid advice.
Vice President Herman, we haven't heard from you yet. Would you like to make some comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would say that in addition to Dr. Jackson, just to your knowledge, I spent 10 years working with the American Association of Medical Colleges on developing national standards for financial conflict of interest in clinical research. So I think we both represent some knowledge base on what's appropriate and what's current state of the art moving forward. The second thing I would say is that I agree with Dr. Jackson and President Kaler and Regent Simmons that, you know, we are taking the facts from both of these reviews very seriously, and while we had already implemented a number of the changes that were recommended prior to receiving the report, there are others that we will look at in a very short time frame and come back with a very aggressive plan to implement many of those recommendations, that actions. I think we all see an opportunity to continually improve in what we do, whether it's in our research mission, our education mission, our service mission, and we're always trying to constantly re-examine how we do things and to make ourselves better. And so I think our intent is to take these recommendations, and in fact, the President didn't mention this, but as part of the charge he's given to Dr. Jackson and myself, it includes looking at our current conflict of interest structure and management structure, and looking at whether changes should be made in that to give us a
process that's more facile and more current, more state-of-the-art. So I look forward to working hard with our team here and implementing a lot of these recommendations and coming back to you and reporting about the fact that Minnesota now has a program that is a national model and the envy of others. Thank you.
Thank you. And we look forward to that day, too. And we will, before the session ends, reconvene this group and hear the progress, as well as I'm sure you'll see some legislative proposal come forward as a result. But it has, while it's been a tough conversation, I think it's been rewarding to hear that we have taken the time to look at what has not worked. And I appreciate President Kaler, your leadership, and Regent Simmons, and really do have great respect for the depth of knowledge and expertise that we are joined by today. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question, I think, as a couple of comments. First of all, as I've started to look at this, I'm pleased to say that the university has been very responsive to my questions and queries, and I appreciate that. I am still concerned, and I trust Regent Simmons that this is at the forefront of your mind, and it goes a little bit to what Senator Sharon was saying. I wasn't happy with the Faculty Senate's response to my question around, are we doing a better job when we get these types of concerns raised by family members regarding the treatment of our patients. And when you look back at, even in the Senate faculty report, university personnel described fatigue related to the criticism of the university's human rights protection program. And I think we're here 11 years later because we didn't have a good investigation up front, because we didn't do the right steps that we should have taken on early in the process. To the culture issue, though, that I think Senator Sharon raised is also expressed in the faculty report, that the university has failed to understand and remedy problems stemming from and related to Markinson. They commonly conveyed a sense of doubt in the leadership's commitment to human subjects protection, and that leaders in the Department of Psychiatry, they were described as untrustworthy and creating a culture of fear. We need ethical people in those leadership roles, and I trust, Senator Kaler, you're starting to put them in. But I find that extremely disturbing, because you can't have an ethical program unless you have ethical people, until you develop the right culture. And people who are willing to look at themselves critically and admit to their mistakes. That's why we're here 11 years later.
President Kaler.
Thank you, Chair Bonhoff. Senator Pratt, I don't know that I have a very good answer to your comment, except to say you're right. We clearly have found portions of our operation where there is a culture that isn't what we need to have in order to provide best care for our patients. Some of that is complicated by the interface that we have with Fairview and nurses that are employed by Fairview and doctors that are employed by the U. But that's not a valid excuse. It makes it more complicated. But part of our action plan will be to understand the kinds of training, the kind of communication, the kind of outreach and mutual respect that we need to build in those units so that we have the right kind of outcomes. And if we need to make staffing changes to make that happen, we will.
And I know that we are joined by many citizens in the room today, and so there always is at any hearing the opportunity for public testimony, and we'll certainly open up the room for that. But I do want to thank those citizens who have been the ones really to clamor for a thorough review, and that's one of the beauties of serving in the legislature, is we really are responsive to the citizens who put us here. So I want to thank all those who have demanded that a more thorough investigation be enacted happen, and thank those who have been working for a long time to make sure that we got to have this kind of conversation. So thank you. So if there are members of the public who wish to approach the table, you're welcome to do that. Is there anybody who would wish to testify? Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Patrice Nirad. I'm working on my doctoral dissertation right now on the systemic issues related to some of what they're discussing, but boards of medical practice and the civil commitment process. Senator Pratt raised some issues that I want to address, one of them being the issue of immunity. When you talk about holding people responsible for their actions, whether they're on a board of medical practice, whether they're tied to some civil commitment process, or the professors that are doing the research at the U. So in a hearing, when Mary Weiss sued the university, they were said to have immunity. The legislature bestows immunity in many of these processes to people. So how do we have responsibility for our actions if we all have immunity and think we can walk away? How come it has taken this long for this to even come to this level, you know, of a discussion? I applaud you for initiating the law in, what is it, 09? Dan's Law? Or was that 011? Was that
11? The legislature enacted that.
Right, for you. Legislate and for the auditors to come up with this report. But it shouldn't have taken this long. But as long as we don't have responsibility in our systems, because we've bestowed immunity extensively throughout this whole process, we have a problem. Our boards also have that issue. Our boards of medical practice, social work, our legal boards. So you have a huge systemic issue, which is what I've been trying to address, you know, in my dissertation, and as well with some of the past committees, Health and Human Services committees.
And when will your dissertation be complete?
Shortly.
Well, we look forward to reading it.
I think I'll hand it out to everyone. But anyway, thank you.
Your comments are noted. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Yes. Anybody else like to approach the table? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Steve Olson. I'm associate professor of psychiatry at the university and the subject of much of the legislative auditor's report. I've been a psychiatrist for more than 30 years and specialize in the treatment of people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe depression. So I fully understand the importance of prevention of suicide, which is our worst outcome, as someone earlier mentioned. In every case of suicide, the survivors, whether those are family, friends, the psychiatrists, the nurses, the healthcare providers, inevitably ask, what if, what should I have done, what did I miss? And there's a sense that something has to be found accountable. And usually there we don't know the answer, and I think that's the case in the case of Dan Markinson, his death, for which I'm very sorry for the loss to the family, and I wish that things had happened differently, but I don't believe there was anything about participation in the drug trial, about my conduct. We paid attention to what we were being told from a whole variety of sources, not just Ms. Weiss, but the many providers that were involved with this care. And we did the best we can. Yes, we could second guess. Again, it's a what if. But in the 11 years since Dan Markinson committed suicide, probably close to 7,000 other Minnesotans have died by suicide. And the one thing that we can say with a great degree of assurance is, what if they didn't have a mental illness, or what if we had better treatments for mental illness, which is why we need the research that's being done. And we can't limit it to people who are outpatients. Whenever we work with people who are seriously ill, I'm well aware of the issues of coercion, possibility of a patient perceiving that they're being kept institutionalized. But Mr. Markinson repeated on a number of occasions that he was aware that there were other treatment options, to see a different psychiatrist. He wanted to be in the study. He thought he was getting good care, and that's repeated in the testimony. So we try to do the best care. We put the patient's interest first over the goals of the research study or any financial incentives. But we have to be able to do research in the sickest patients, or we're not going to make any progress. I did want to address the specific issues about whether he was doing well and how could we randomize him to a different drug. And I think that actually Dean Jackson summarized very well the issue that affects individuals with early psychotic illness. The study was designed to treat people who had been in the early weeks and months of treatment for psychosis. And in that population, all the available medications are relatively effective in reducing symptoms. But nevertheless, the majority of patients stop their treatment and an average of 4 to 5 months later, and then they're highly vulnerable to relapse. And the goal of a program like the CAFE study was to try to define whether one of or another of commonly used medications were better at keeping patients in treatment when they were doing satisfactorily. And so the question of whether he was doing well or not oversimplifies things. Schizophrenia is very complicated, a whole range of symptoms. We've already heard that his mother thought he was never doing well in the study. And yet, if he was doing well, why did we randomize him? So I think we have a lot to do better at, and I will welcome the new changes that will come along. Clinical research is evolving like the rest of medicine and science, and we expect things that we're doing now to be better than standards 10 years ago or 20 years or 30 years ago. So I'll continue to provide the best care for the patients and hopefully advance the cause of being able to get better treatments for mental illness.
Dr. Olson, I'm sure it must have been very difficult to both listen today but kind of relive what happened back then from having this discussion. But I also do hope that you did hear very loud and clear that we actually find that there were very troubling conflicts of interest surrounding the whole review of the matter, and that we found the review of the matter woefully inadequate, and so that your remarks were centered around that nothing went wrong. Not that nothing went wrong, because you didn't say that, but you did not address what the comments around the table have been.
Yeah, absolutely. I also had no knowledge of what was going on. I provided information that the IRB asked for, and others at the university and the medical board. I have had until recently, within the last month, had no knowledge of the internal workings of the Board of Medical Practice. I've always said that I would welcome any investigation that looks fairly at both sides of the issue and reviews all of the information available and the testimony that's, for the large part, in the public record that bears on the issues of coercion and Dan's ability as a voluntary adult person who was not committed, the conflict of interest, the incentives for the treatment, and our attention to his state, and that the providers that were working with him all felt that he was making satisfactory progress, and he was moving into an apartment, and he was graduating from his day treatment program. and his suicide was a huge shock to all of us.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and fellow senators. My name is Lee Turner. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and I've been involved calling for an investigation along with my colleague, Professor Elliott, for many years now. I'd like to just make a couple of observations. First of all, I'd like to point out that I understand there's a temptation to kind of go with the narrative that all characters have changed at the university, and there's been turnover, and none of the characters from over a decade ago are still in place. Of course, like all big institutions, there have been changes, but there's a great deal of continuity. So, for example, Dr. Olson is still there. There's been no consequences for his career. There's been no punishment at all of any kind, despite what you found in here. Dr. Schultz, who runs a department, is chair of the Department of Psychiatry. The report that you referred to mentions aggressive recruiting tactics and a culture of intimidation where whistleblowers are fearful and afraid of speaking out. That's the department he runs. There's been no consequences for him. He was chair of psychiatry then. He's chair of psychiatry today. I think that says something about the higher levels of administration in the University of Minnesota keeping these individuals in place without professional consequences of any kind. So I want to point out that, in fact, there's significant continuity. Another element of continuity is that if you think about how the University of Minnesota has responded to these allegations over the years, tremendous continuity. The faces change. The names change. The university's PR strategy, which is what you're getting today, has remained the same. And so you really keep hearing the same thing. Even now, there's still a kind of high level of denial taking place. So I want to suggest that, yes, it's true that while some of the senior ministers in place when Dan Markinson died are gone, much of the message remains the same today. And in fact, until this, they've maintained the line that there's no need for an investigation of any kind, no need for further inquiries. The FDA report continues to be held up as a shield today. So I want to emphasize the way in which, really, for over a decade, we've heard much the same kind of message, which is there's no need to investigate the Markinson case. Now, in fact, if you hadn't if the Office of Legislative Auditor hadn't been involved, if this report didn't exist, we wouldn't have this. We wouldn't know much of this. And think about that narrative would still continue. We wouldn't have this really indictment of the – I mean, calling this incompetent oversight is really too generous. We wouldn't have that. And so look what we found by actually doing an investigation. This could have easily not have happened today. The other point that I want to make is that President Kaler and his colleagues – are coming here in some respects. There's some crocodile tears. There's some sense that they're doing something. Let me emphasize that there have been years where much of what you heard today could have been done. My colleague Carl Elliott wrote a piece for Mother Jones in 2010 identifying many of the ethical issues and regulatory concerns identified in this report. Not all. I mean, let me emphasize Mr. Nobles and his colleagues the fine job they've done finding new material, for example. But much of what we're talking about today could have occurred 5 years ago. But it didn't, because the university has again and again said there was no need for an investigation. In May 2013, nearly 2 years ago, I wrote to President Kaler pointing out problems with the reports that you've mentioned. And yet, here he is, yet again, if these external reviews were flawed, we were not aware of those shortcomings. That's a false statement. You're actually being given false statements. And so when you emphasize, you know, wanting to trust President Kaler, that's how we all feel here today. We want to be able to trust President Kaler and other administrators. And yet we're being given highly misleading statements. And so what I would like to say is, that the FDA investigation, there were many problems with it in terms of taking for granted Markinson had decision-making capacity, that he could provide informed consent. These problems have been identified for years. There's been many questions about the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice and the adequacy of that investigation. The fact that the IRB did nothing in the way of a meaningful investigation. These problems have been identified. They've been brought to President Kaler's attention for years. They've been brought to Richard Beeson's attention, chair of the Board of Regents, for years. They did nothing. Their plan was to do nothing until today, when it's so much here in terms of what they must confront. They finally must do something. They could have done those things years ago, and yet they chose not to. I think that says a tremendous amount about how they're approaching this and really the lack of leadership this university has had since the time President Kaler arrived. All of this could have been done shortly after he arrived. It did not. Even now, I think many of us remain concerned about whether any meaningful action will take place.
So, Dr. Turner, thank you for sharing your thoughts. What I would say is I'm sure that given the years and the, you know, the tremendous amount of energy you've put into this, again, it, very frustrating. I can appreciate the depth of your anger over having this not really be looked at fully, as you state. But today it really has been. And so I'm going to take the president's remarks in good faith, and I am going to, not blindly, as Auditor Noble said, trust and verify. Mm-hmm. We are going to revisit, and we're going to take Regent Simmons at her word that she's going to provide a new kind of oversight, and we're going to ask people to come back and tell us, how's it going? We're going to check in and find out with faculty, how's it going? So we can't do anything about what didn't happen. You know, I started out the comment saying when I first became chair, people asked me to do this very thing, and it took me some time until I, too, became clear an investigation needed to be done because no full-scale investigation had happened. So, it, you know, we are where we are, and I appreciate you taking the time to come and give your words and would ask that you consider, just consider, that maybe significant changes are going to occur.
I trust that when you say it, it's President Kaler where I have my reservations. If I can say one thing about the FDA investigation, it is known that the FDA met again with Dr. Olson in November 2014. I think we should be cautious about assuming that that investigation took place and everything was put to bed and there's nothing left. There may, in fact, be a federal investigation ongoing right now. That's something else that it would have been good to have the university administrators address here today. But, of course, we heard no word of that.
Well, actually, there's nothing that can be said because that is not public in terms of what their findings are. We look forward to getting that information.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to come up. First of all, I'm Roberta Opheim. I'm the state ombudsman for mental health and developmental disabilities, and my name appear or our agency appears in this report on and off. So, but there were a couple of comments I wanted to make. One is we were probably the first external body to review this death. But to put that in context, you know, we don't do the level of death reviews that the auditor was able to do in this particular one, partly because of size and resources, but partly because our review is non-regulatory, and it's non-regulatory so that we can look deeper and speak louder and speak out when we see something. We had 8 recommendations that were sent to the university. At times, I did cringe that every time I saw a report that said no study ever found fault, those recommendations were designed to improve conditions so that people in the future, so we don't particularly say a particular individual is at fault. We looked at the process, and we found the process to be at fault, and we made recommendations for changes in the process. But and we continue to do that. We have a very august body of a medical review specialist who come and serve, thankfully, for Minnesota at no cost. These are doctors, psychiatrists, nurses, internists, forensic pathologists, and psychopharmacologists who review the deaths. And many deaths are natural. And very few are ever involved in research. So, but we did see some problems. We addressed the concerns, and we forwarded them to the university. But at that point, we have no regulatory authority to force anyone to do anything. The bigger concern I have, and one that was not addressed fully in the report or anywhere here today, is the fact that the mother of Dan Markingson, the person who knew him the best, was not listened to. And this is not unique to issues at the university. We see this elsewhere, so I don't want to put this on the university. But when you have an adult child with a mental illness and the families involved. Sometimes they are on the same pathway. Sometimes they disagree. But the number of times that families' information is ignored is tremendous. Now, people can disagree, but there is some sense that we're the experts. We don't need to listen to anyone else. And yet, being a mother myself, I know that I have insights into my children, which they may or may not agree with, but I've had ample years to observe behaviors, patterns of behaviors, when they're acting differently, when they're acting in their normal range. So we need research. I'm not against research. But I want, but as the state's primary advocate on behalf of people receiving services and treatment, and I don't think, based on the number of individuals that I have talked to who have been through the civil commitment process, whether they were finally committed or issued a stay of commitment, that we, that any of us can fully understand how overwhelmed and coerced they feel. Even if nobody says, do this or else, because I don't think that happened. I really don't. But there is an ingrained perspective that if you have not been through the civil commitment process, you don't understand what it's like to be told you cannot control your life, we are going to let other people control your life. And then to be told you will be committed if you don't follow all the recommendations of your treatment team. So the one thing I would ask for is that families be given a voice and listened to and considered and not dismissed so easily. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work. Anybody else? Mr. Howard.
Thank you, Chair Bonoff. My name is Mike Howard and a close friend of Mary Weiss. Mary cannot be here. She is in severe stroke recovery and some days basically can't talk at all. Today was one of those days. I think the emotional anxiety of this report coming out and the last 10 or 11 years have certainly taken their toll. But she has asked me to first off express thank you to the chair for having this hearing. Thank you for Mr. Nobles for conducting a very thorough, independent investigation, the first time that that's been done. I mean, thoroughly independent. Mr. Nobles had no basically, he wasn't looking for anything but the truth. And he found it, and it stands. I'm not here to get into an argument with anybody from the university. Though Dr. Jackson and I could probably... we've never met, but I disagree with a number of things he said, especially about the CAFE study. Same thing with Dr. Olson. Facts are facts. This was a mentally ill young man and who did not understand what he was doing. He wasn't even a resident of Minnesota. He lived in California, wanted to go home. For him, home was to follow recommendations and get there. At one point, he was going to hitchhike from Minnesota till his money ran out and try to grab a cab and all different kinds of things. These are all in the records. But again, that doesn't matter. Nothing is going to change anything for Dan Markinson. But hopefully, what Mr. Noble's report will do will make it and change things for people in the future. That's what Mary has asked me to express today, is that you folks have that power. The university now hopefully will wake up and admit it. And that's what it comes to. You can never correct a fault if you don't admit that it exists. And I don't see how you can say that you've been exonerated when they've hid behind statutory immunity, which dropped the lawsuit. The lawsuit didn't, you know, proceed. If the U thought they had nothing wrong, why not have the lawsuit? Then you can claim all your immunity or exoneration you want. That they chose immunity and then used the words exonerated. I'm sorry, that's wrong. Just tell the truth. Get it out there and then deal with it. That's all Mary Weiss ever looked for, just the truth. This was a desperate woman, a single mother, losing her only son, begging with the doctor, begging the doctor to help her son. He was not getting better, and you're absolutely right. Who knew her son better than her? Not Dr. Olson, not the treatment team, the mother. And they were she was ignored. Ignored. And hopefully after today, that never happens again, folks. I mean, I love the University of Minnesota. I'm like Governor Arne Carlson. I bleed maroon and gold, at least the sports. And I love what the university has done. But I despise the Department of Psychiatry right now because they're incapable of admitting fault. All the apologies 11 years later, believe me, they could have knocked on Mary's door any day for 11 years and said, you know what, I'm sorry. We made a mistake. How do we fix this? What can we do? Can you help us fix what's wrong? Because we're blinded. We're living in a box. We only see one part of it. That's what I hope comes from Mr. Noble's report. Save other people. We have been contacted by 24 families that have had issues with the Department of Psychiatry. They're out there. You know what they're? They're afraid. The university, we should pass laws in this state about bullying because that's what the U does to people. Hopefully that ends today. Enough is enough. Let's just fix this problem once and for all, and yes, make it a wonderful university, but save some lives, because if we don't, it's going to happen again. Thank you.
So, Mr. Howard, I want to acknowledge that you have now been the voice of Mary Weiss today, as well as all those folks who have contacted you, and so we hear you. Your comments are noted. Your comments to the university, I would ask President Kaler if he would like to respond in any way, but I'm quite certain that he has heard you loud and clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? So,
Madam Chair?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yes.
I'm Sheila Van Pelt. I'm a private citizen. We know each other for other reasons, but what I want to do is chime on your words, Roberta Hoppine. Thank you. Families' voices do matter, and we do know our family members the best. We do have facts and data that cannot sometimes just not be challenged. And as you know, there's been legislation that has passed to address it and make it important that families' voices are a part of proceedings that happen, and I'm very thankful for that. And the work continues on. But I want us to address our conflicts of interest, and that all of us, no matter where we are at, we look at them, we recognize them. So how, when we move forward in doing our work, are we recusing ourselves where necessary? Are we doing what is right? That we acknowledge the power of relationships that exist in many bodies, that exist within the Capitol, that we exist with extenuating relationships that can impact all of us, and that we come to just look at how we are conducting ourselves. I've heard the word ethical, quality, you know, just the quality types of things that we look within each of us who we are, and are we operating as we should, or are we listening to the external voices and powers and pressures that are out there that are potentially influencing how we go about our daily work? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Van. Okay. Well, again, we thank all for participating, and we affirm our commitment to the university and its mission. So, thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.